organization, always there at our events. I just thought at some point that it's a shame not to have her as a speaker. Ambassador Camara has had a very illustrious career as a politician. And these days we think politician is a dirty word. People on the street are calling for the abolition of parties, although I hear that they want to set up their own party now. So there is something to be said about the quality and the purpose of politics. But Sheila has been involved in South Africa's transition from apartheid. She served in the South African Parliament before and after and was part of the cabinet under both President de Klerk and later under Nelson Mandela. And she's very well positioned to enlighten us about the experience of South Africa, the multiple transitions there, not just the political system, but also all issues concerning economic empowerment for the marginalized majority in the country. Sometimes people think that you cannot compare apples and oranges. Bulgaria is so much different. We are so specific. But I personally believe that there is value in all comparisons. If only we could learn about other people's successes and challenges and exchange experiences. I don't like the word lesson because it's probably a bit too paternalistic. But let me stop here and I'll pass the floor to Sheila, and then we hear from our two discussants, and I'll introduce them later on to you. So over to you, Sheila, and thanks once more for being with us.
Thank you very much, Dimitar, for that kind introduction. And discussants, Mr. Smilov and Dr. Kostadinova, excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming this evening. I suppose I'm talking about regime change, in a sense, and what a day we've chosen, with very dramatic regime change, or about to change, in this country. Obviously, Dimitar has a sixth sense for these kind of things. As you know, he's a well-known commentator on political issues in Bulgaria. Anyway, I'd like to thank you for inviting me to give the talk, especially since 2013 is the 20th anniversary of the negotiated political settlement that ended apartheid in my country. The political settlement was between 19 negotiating parties, some political, some tribal, and some NGO groupings, and was embodied in an interim constitution for South Africa that was signed and sealed by all the leaders of the groups in a ceremony in December 1993, presided over by Nelson Mandela, then the leader of the African National Congress, who would be elected president of South Africa in the first democratic elections held 4 months later in April 1994, as well as the then president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk. Much of the credit for our peaceful political settlement must be given to the wise leadership of our country at that time by these two men, both of whom were deservedly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. I had the privilege of working closely with both of them. De Klerk is a canny pragmatist who fortunately could see the bigger picture. Mandela, in his everyday dealings with people, is truly as saintly as he appears. I could tell you a lot of anecdotes about my dealings with Mr. Mandela, but it'll take too long. If you want to ask me about them when I finish my presentation, certainly. He was always extraordinarily nice to me, and he certainly had no particular reason to be so. It is a particular pleasure because I was in a privileged position of being part of this process from the beginning of it in November 1991, right through to when the final constitution was adopted in December 1996. I was part of President F.W. de Klerk's team at the multi-party talks known by the acronym CODESA. I don't know if Boyke, have you put up the CODESA? That was this, the acronym. And as Deputy Minister of Justice, I was chief negotiator for my party on the Bill of Human Rights in our Constitution. When he appointed me as Deputy Minister, I remember Mr. de Klerk said, "There's no more desirable job for a lawyer than helping to draft a constitution." The 1993 interim constitution provided a framework for the initial stage of South Africa's transition to democracy, for the democratic elections to take place, for a constitutional court to be nominated and appointed, among other things. Once the democratic parliament was elected, it also sat as a constitutional assembly. And the final constitution was adopted just 3 years later, as I said. There were safeguards to ensure that it would not depart dramatically from the political settlement embodied in the 1993 constitution, namely 34 constitutional principles, which could not be deviated from in the final constitution. In fact, the newly appointed constitutional court, which had to vet the final product, found indeed that the first draft submitted had violated six of them, and it had to be revised. The court sent it back to Parliament, and that resulted in a six-month delay, which is why it was adopted eventually in December 96. 2013 also marks the return to national politics of the African National Congress as chief negotiator at the time, and Mr. Mandela's right-hand man, Cyril Ramaphosa, now 60, who left for the world of business, where he became a multimillionaire after delivery of the final constitution in 96. He has just been elected deputy president of the African National Congress in December, which sets him on a trajectory to become president of South Africa in the not-too-distant future. He is one of the most brilliant men I've ever met, and I worked with him throughout the negotiations. According to a recent front-page feature article in the New York Times, he's a charming manipulator in multiple languages. South Africa has 11 official languages guaranteed in our constitution. He's adept at creating tension and diffusing it. I remember I was once the butt of his creating tension, and there was high drama over some intervention I'd made, which I usually tried not to do when he was around. And anyway, everybody walked out. Eventually we came back, and then he made us sing. And the song he always made us sing was, "Give me a deal to build a dream on." And it was ridiculous. He had all these, him conducting that. But he could really manipulate people very well. He resolved the problem that arises when you have 19 negotiating parties, some of which matter more than others. How do you know when something should be regarded as decided? He came up with the concept of sufficient consensus. Mr. Ramaphosa apparently explained to a reporter at the time that this basically meant that if the National Party and the African National Congress came to terms, then everybody else could get stuffed. But he never used language like that in the negotiation. The process was as important as the result, since the main protagonists got to know each other well by the time most of them landed up together in the new democratic parliament. Also, one of the keys to the success of the process was its transparency. Night after night, the negotiators were doing it live on TV, and also the inclusivity of the process. Anybody could make submissions to CODESA. In the short time available, it will be impossible to go into much detail, but I will try and highlight what I regard as a few important aspects of our transition. It's, as I said, almost a generation since South Africa wrote what is regarded as one of the most progressive constitutions on the planet. It's expansive in bestowing rights, and Section 9, the Equality Clause in the Bill of Rights, outlaws discrimination based not only on race and gender, but also on sexual orientation, sex, pregnancy, marital status, ethnic and social origin, color, belief, culture, language, and birth, somewhat similar to the provision in the Bulgarian Constitution. Our Constitutional Court has been similarly expansive in its interpretation of this language. It is in several respects more liberal than South Africa's public opinion. Capital punishment was outlawed by the Constitutional Court in 1995 on the basis of an unconditional right to life in the interim Constitution of 93. That was a big issue then, because at the time we had 490 people on death row, and I would say 85 to 87% of them were black men. Many of them were there because they'd committed crimes with a political motive. It was certainly one of the big issues. The court also ruled in 2005, based on the Equality Clause, that gays and lesbians could marry. Neither outcome, I must say, would survive a referendum in South Africa, as our country is socially conservative. Big rights issues in the final constitution of 1996 were the right to strike and safeguarding property rights, because the trade unions had really organized themselves to make major submissions at that time. The Constitution doesn't have a right to lockout, interestingly enough, because of that. But we have a very satisfactory safeguarding of property rights. I must say the property rights and the right to strike were the two last clauses that were finally agreed in the final negotiations of the final constitution, because we just had to have the wording ready when people were ready to agree. It was fun to be a lawyer, as I said. I want to say there's no specific protection for minorities in terms of the Bill of Rights itself. That is taken care of in another way, which I'll get to, but also through the Equality Clause. That's meant to be enough. The court has also done some very pioneering work on second-generation rights, such as the right of access to housing, right of access to health services and education, and has become quite proactive, occasionally demanding that government structures report back to it on progress, which the government hates. I would like to draw attention to the fact that, as in the Bulgarian constitution, the concept of human dignity is central to it. Section 1 of ours provides that South Africa is founded on the following values: human dignity, the achievement of equality, and the advancement of human rights and freedoms. And Section 10 states everyone has inherent dignity and the right to have their dignity respected and protected. At this point, I'd just like to make a few remarks about the judiciary and how the South African transition dealt with the judiciary. In order to ensure continuity and legal certainty, it was decided to leave the judiciary as it was in 1993, but to introduce structures to reform it on a gradualist basis. Pre-93, our highest court was the Supreme Court of Appeal. It and the provincial high courts were peopled with white men, save for one white woman and one Indian recently appointed on the Supreme Court of Appeal, Ismail Mohammed, a South African Indian who was also acting Chief Justice of our neighboring country, Namibia, at the time. This was clearly unsatisfactory because 80% of South Africans are black. So it was decided to introduce a constitutional court as the apex court above the Supreme Court of Appeal, with 11 judges. And the newly elected parliament would hold interviews, nominate, and then the president would appoint these judges. The constitution only requires that they are fit and proper persons for appointment, although at least four of them must have been high court judges at the time of appointment. The other reform measure was to establish a judicial service commission of 24 persons. Similar to the Bulgarian Supreme Judicial Council, this body comprises nominees from Parliament, from the President, and organized legal profession. It interviews and decides on appointments of judges to all high courts and the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court. It makes recommendations to the President in the latter case. The Judicial Service Commission is guided by the following provision in our Constitution: the need for the judiciary to reflect broadly the racial and gender composition of South Africa must be considered when making appointments. We have had some success with this. In 1994, the Constitutional Court was composed of 7 white judges and 4 black judges, which included colored and Indian judges, of which 9 were men and 2 women. The first Chief Justice was our Indian judge, Ismail Mohammed. Incidentally, the second Chief Justice was Jewish and white, Arthur Chaskelson, and the last two have been black, Pius Lange and Kobel. All men, though. Today, the Constitutional Court has 8 black judges and 3 white judges, although the number of women remains 2. Similar changes have happened in the ranks of the High Court judges, so that more than 60% of them are now black and coloured and Indian. Only 25% are women, but that's an improvement over 1. And the Judicial Service Commission, in implementing this principle, always nominated a black candidate for appointment if all things were equal, and a woman, if one was available, again, if the candidates were equally eligible. I sat on the Judicial Service Commission for 10 years as one of the 6 members nominated by Parliament. And the secret of success of the system was absolute transparency. Candidates for judicial appointment are interviewed or grilled by the whole of the Judicial Service Commission in public and with the media present. There is no place to hide for an unsuitable candidate, and in no way for the Judicial Service Commission to escape criticism if they nominate an unsuitable candidate, which has happened once or twice, but not often, luckily. When I explained to the former Supreme Judicial Council of Bulgaria, some members, I had lunch with them, how ours worked, they were deeply shocked and said that only merit should apply and you should never bring in these extraneous issues. But I'm very pleased that you have a new Supreme Judicial Council who seems to be prepared to look broader and do things in a more transparent way. So this is the way our judiciary has been gradually transformed but has maintained a very high standard. The institutional framework to uphold constitutional democracy put in place by our constitution is extensive and strong. It includes what we call Chapter 9 institutions, the institutions supporting constitutional democracy, including the South African Human Rights Commission, the Commission on Gender Equality, the Commission, and this is where the minorities in certain aspects get protection, the Commission for the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Cultural, Religious, and Linguistic Communities. Because of our past, we don't talk about minorities and we don't talk about race in any of this. We call it the Culture Commission for short. And we have our ombudsman, who's a woman actually, public protector, is the name given to the office. It is true their functions overlap sometimes and people go forum shopping. On the other hand, they have mostly performed very well in holding the government at all levels to account and enforcing the rights of citizens. This quite apart from the courts, the labor dispute resolution mechanisms that we have, and the media. And I think I must mention the media here. We have the right in the Constitution, Section 16, to a free media and freedom of expression, etc. We have a very, fearless media, an aggressive media. And we have a number of big groups that own groups of papers. But what has been interesting is to see that the top editors of the best and most read newspapers in our country, mostly the editors are black, and they mostly give the government help. So I think we can say that we have a very free and open discussion in our country, in the media. If I just want to compare South Africa's position with that of Bulgaria, if you compare the history, social development, and political position of the two countries, some similarities are striking. Both were subject to oppressive systems until 1990. Bulgaria was under communist domination, and South Africa was under apartheid. Both Bulgaria and South Africa made the transition from a discriminatory and oppressive system to full democracy without a revolution. I think we can say that. Although during the dying days of apartheid, there were severe disruptions to normal life, events such as bombs going off in shopping malls, power stations, airports, secret cross-border raids by our defense force, assassinations of anti-apartheid activists in neighboring countries, and financial and economic sanctions, which caused huge damage to South Africa's economy. But it never amounted to a civil war. To illustrate the point about the damage to our economy, in 1994, at the time of our first democratic election, South Africa's gross domestic product totaled only $60 billion. Today, it's in excess of $450 billion. So democracy has been hugely beneficial to our economic development. If you consider that Italy's GDP has actually remained the same during the same period, and many other European countries. So you can see that it's helped us as a country. Both countries, both Bulgaria and South Africa, are now middle-income emerging economies, which until the financial crisis experienced satisfactory growth. Both struggle with corruption. The latest Transparency International ratings place South Africa, together with Brazil, in 69th place with 43 points. Bulgaria's in 71st place with 41 points. So there's not much much difference there. I'd just like to briefly highlight the role of women in our transition. This may not be an issue in Bulgaria with its communist past, where gender equality was practiced at least in the workplace, but it is certainly an issue in Africa, North and South, where gender equality is an issue for both Muslim and tribal societies and keeps cropping up in relation to the constitutional outcomes in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt, for example, more recently, that is to say. The South African Constitution, therefore, had mothers as well as fathers, but only because women of South Africa put up a fight for it. When leading African National Congress women returned from exile in 1990-91, they got together with women from other political parties and formed the Women's Coalition across party lines to lobby for women's participation and women's rights in the negotiation process. This turned out to be a very effective group, and possibly party leadership was influenced by the prospect of nearly 10 million new female voters in the 94 elections. But the result was that there was a ruling that each of the 19 negotiating teams had to have a woman. The way they put it was rather old-fashioned. They said each team must have one leader and one woman, presuming the woman wouldn't be the leader. So, of course, they were taken to task immediately. In fact, some teams did have women. To achieve the equality clause in the Constitution was a tough battle against the traditional leaders, who were well represented in the talks. In South Africa's tribal societies, women's equality didn't exist. For instance, they had no contractual capacity, could not own land, etc. And the prospect of equality truly horrified the chiefs. There was eventually a showdown, and the chiefs were offered a sunset clause on equality by the Women's Coalition, but they turned it down, and so they lost out completely. Today, South Africa's parliament has about 37% women members, and 40% of the members of the cabinet are women. Top positions in business and the judiciary are harder nuts to crack, as I said, but progress is being made. In conclusion of my initial remarks, I'd like to talk about the Truth Commission. This was perhaps South Africa's opportunity as a nation to make peace with itself after so much oppression, suffering, bloodletting, and so on. It was, again, born as a political compromise, one of many that we found in the negotiating settlement. The protagonists of it rejected the Nuremberg-style trials option on the basis that if apartheid was to be defeated at the negotiating table, there could be no such trials. Negotiations were unlikely to begin, let alone succeed, if the outgoing regime knew they faced criminal trials once they had given up power. In addition, the resentment this could cause in a divided nation was taken into account. Instead, South Africa chose the path of moral accountability for apartheid crimes. Through granting of amnesty for crimes committed for political motives based on truth-telling before our Truth and Reconciliation Commission, with the emphasis in our case on reconciliation. This was predicated on the postamble to the 93 Constitution, the interim one, which provided that amnesty would be granted for such criminal acts in terms of a certain mechanism, which wasn't defined then, but which became the Truth Commission. The parameters of this were negotiated in Parliament once the Democratic Parliament was elected. I was a member of the Parliamentary Committee which drafted the Truth Commission legislation, and it was a very tough negotiation. Among issues which arose was whether it was possible to shoulder collective guilt for crimes with a political motive, i.e., could a general shoulder it on behalf of the troops under him? The decision in the end was no. Each individual had to admit guilt and tell the truth in order to get amnesty individually. Incidentally, I must say, the leaders of both the African National Congress, or the leadership, and the National Party ignored this provision, but somehow it wasn't pursued. The first meeting of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission took place on the 16th of December 1995 at the official residence of its chairman, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The report, which runs to five volumes, was presented to President Nelson Mandela just under 3 years later, on the 29th of October 1998. South Africa's TRC was not the first Truth Commission, and as a parliamentary committee drafting the legislation, we went to study other examples, in Chile, for instance. But it differed from those because the whole process was open to the public and the media. In other words, every day for almost 3 years, South Africans of all persuasions were confronted with the evidence of victims or perpetrators of human rights violations. It was in the papers, radio, TV, daily and nightly. Perhaps never before in modern history have people told their story so fully and movingly. Again, the process was important and it was totally transparent. Many believe it would not have been impossible for our society to be where it is today if we'd not gone through this process, because it gave our country the opportunity to come to terms with the past and provide a foundation for rebuilding the country on the basis of a human rights culture. The reconstruction of South African society on the basis of a shared vision, on the need for mutual understanding, not for vengeance, for reparation rather than retaliation, and for Ubuntu, which is a South African indigenous word meaning human kindness. There is no parallel for this in Bulgaria. Instead, you have the slow release of the list of names of those who were informants for the communist regime. I'm afraid this is a rather simplistic view of things from a foreigner, but that's what I observed. Possibly as an ancient country in Europe, it was not necessary. However, when one considers the simmering enmities that continue today in the Balkan region, it might have had some relevance at the time. Thank you very much. I've gone on rather long, but you mentioned, Demeter, you mentioned economic transformation. And that is really, if I may just say in a postscript, what South Africa faces today. A lot of the leading people in our country are talking about an economic CODESA and the need to have one. I think if anybody reads the international media, they'll have seen we've had a whole wave of strikes in the mining industry and in agriculture because the difference between the haves and the have-nots has become increasingly great. And I think this year it's either Brazil or ourselves who have the worst Gini coefficient rating. I think at the moment it's us. It's been there. You know, we swap every now and then. And it's one of the reasons why I think the current government has brought in people like Cyril Ramaphosa into a national role again in politics. He's, as I said, a very, very wealthy man. He's self-made. And he benefited from the Black Economic Empowerment rules that we introduced in order to help the black middle class along, which I think without it, these rules, we would not have achieved what we have today. And also somebody like Tito Mboweni, who was our former central bank governor, and he's a great friend of Ivan Iskra, your central bank governor. So they're emerging.
No, Simeon Biankov.
No, not him. No, the governor. They were already in correspondence, and I told Governor Iskroff that this is the case. And I think attempts are going to be made to have a more inclusive economic transition, which, as I said, has been very uneven up to now. So I think I'll leave it there, and I'm happy. I'm sorry I've gone on rather long, but it's very difficult to talk about all this in a short period, and I'm happy to I'm terrified of these intellectuals here on the table too, but I'm happy to field questions, comments, and so on. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Ambassador Camara, for this overview. It's truly inspiring to be exposed to the South African example of building a rainbow nation, and certainly we could have done much better coming to terms with our past. But one other issue I'd like to highlight at this stage is the judiciary. If I listen carefully to you, you'd say probably it's a success story, and having a functional, professional, and also impartial judiciary is a key determinant of success. I think, isn't it fair to say that's one of the failures of the Bulgarian transition, building a properly functional, workable judiciary? On this question, I pass the floor to Danis Milov, who is the program director at the Center for Liberal Strategies. The CLS is a co-organizer of this event. And Danny is somebody who has dabbled in various aspects of constitutional law and politics in Bulgaria, but also in wider Central and Eastern Europe. So if you could pick up on some of the themes to throw it open for the discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Dimitar, and Your Excellency. Thank you very much for this very enlightening lecture. Well, it is always good to speak about the South African example, which is inspirational in so many ways. But especially, I would like to stress two elements, which I think come out very strongly from the South African example. Well, the first element is, this empowering character of democratic politics. So South Africa is a very good example of how politics can preserve still its emancipatory force. And the transition which South Africa has realized, without the difficulties which still remain, but this is an example of exactly this, how social groups could be emancipated through politics. And I do believe that this is quite an important element, which sometimes is neglected in contemporary democratic politics.
So, you think we are too cynical?
People become too cynical, and they don't believe that they could change things through politics. They don't believe that, politics matters, and actually on the facades of some buildings here in Sofia, you could see inscriptions which say that if elections change anything, they would be prohibited. So this type of cynicism, I think, could be countered by positive examples like South Africa. Well, this is the first thing. And the second thing is, of course, the success in terms of the rule of law and constitutionalism. South Africa comes out very strongly as an example in terms of contemporary, modern constitutionalism. Quite a lot of doctrines are born there, and Gale is going to speak especially about the influence of the judiciary in the socioeconomic area, which is a kind of novel and positive element. Dimo asked me here to speak about the Bulgarian judiciary, so I didn't want to enter exactly into this direction on
you
this.
You can discuss the executive as well.
Well, it's a very complex day of Bulgarian democracy, so to focus on its weakest points probably would be unfair, but I'm going to say something about the Bulgarian judiciary anyhow. On the face of it, all constitutions are very similar. Actually, a friend of mine is doing empirical research, and it turns out that up to 80% of all constitutional provisions in different constitutions in the world are the same. And if you read, really, the equality clauses and the Supreme Judicial Councils and so on, they're pretty similar. Actually, a very facial comparison would say, look, the Bulgarian Constitution has a constitutional court, 12 judges, just like the South African Constitution, the difference being only 11 judges there. Bulgarian Supreme Judicial Council, 25 people. well, just like the South African Supreme Judicial Council, 24 people. So probably we should do a small adjustment, and we could hope that our model will become as successful as the South African. Or probably the Bulgarian parliament could not, continue not appointing 12 judges, so we now have 11 judges anyhow in the Constitutional Court. But this is just kind of very facial and, of course, anecdotal type of comparing things. So when you look at realities, what emerges is that the Bulgarian judiciary has not been able to transform itself into a positive social actor introducing some positive changes in society, and this is probably the real difference. Of course, there are successes in Bulgaria as well. As you said, the Bulgarian Constitutional Court has pretty much established itself, and it has good jurisprudence on many. In many areas, but when you look at the judiciary as a whole, well, it has become, in a justified way, a point of quite a lot of criticism from various sectors of society, and this is because first there are these suspicions of corruption. But secondly, also, it is not clear how this professional group as a whole contributes to the well-being of different groups. So this is one of the challenges that we have. And Bulgaria is one of the, constitutional paradoxes, because from an institutional point of view, we do have all the safeguards that should secure independent and professional judiciary. And despite these, still there are quite a lot of allegations that, even high courts and even Supreme Judicial Council are not that independent, that they keep very kind of suspect links with politicians, businesses, and so on. So now the challenge for us, I think, is to understand that the constitutionalism is not just a set of formal institutions, but also there are quite a lot of practices, informal rules, which have to be developed. And as you said, some such practices as hearings, quite a lot of transparency, and also discussion of what is going on in the judiciary, in the media. These are essential for the functioning of the judiciary as a whole. I do think that we are gradually learning, and there is progress on that front. But definitely we're lagging behind, I think. South Africa on that front. When it comes to gender balance, though, we are much better, especially in the judicial profession. And there are many explanations for this, but one is that, in fact, under communism, the judiciary was not such a powerful profession at all. So the powerful groups were the prosecutors, for instance. So they were male-dominated. Well, the judges, most of them were women. And this affects still, I think, the gender balance in the profession as a whole. So there are these kind of vagaries of historical development which explain differences. Okay, I don't want really to spend too much time on these, because our audience is well educated in the problems of Bulgarian judiciary. Well, actually, I would be interested to know what is your view on this, how we can improve on. Of course, you said that these practices, like the transparency of hearings and so on, could be implemented. But if you have more insights into this area, I'll be really grateful if you share them with us. At the end, probably I will say just a few words about the political process, not so much about the judiciary, but politics. Both South Africa and Bulgaria are successful examples of transition. So we have vigorous democratic processes you might argue that the quality of democracy in both places suffers from certain defects and so on. But still, these are pretty, pretty successful transition examples. After all, despite all current problems, Bulgaria is a country which is a member of the European Union. It has a pretty stable political system, vigorous competition. We witness actually some of the side effects of this the competition and so on. But I just want to share one of my worries, and this is really, it goes towards this direction. It's about the cynicism which has been developed towards politics, and politics as traditionally understood party politics. So party politics and recent developments show that people do not trust parties in general. So there is this kind of sense that party politics is something dirty, it's something inferior to what could be called citizens' initiatives and so on. And this is something worrying to me, because I don't see the point of this kind of stark opposition between the citizens and the political parties, because after all, the political parties should address and should translate in a kind of policies what the citizens want, and so on. So this I find equally problematic from our perspective, and one of the big challenges that we face. And actually, yeah, I would really be glad if you could shed some light from your perspective on these developments.
So, how do we cure cynicism, if there is a cure? Now I'll pass the floor to Galina Kostadinova. Galina is doing a doctorate at Oxford University, looking at the plight of Roma in the EU. And obviously, the example of South Africa in the area of socio-economic rights and the jurisprudence of the courts offers some interesting insights into how the plight of marginalized groups can be addressed. And I'm sure Galina has a lot of interesting thoughts to share about the South African example and what it tells us.
Thank you. Dobar večer. I was asked to speak in English like the other participants, so here we go. I'm tempted first to react to a few points before I move on to the role of courts. The first one is on women's rights and gender issues in Bulgaria. Although Ms. Kammerer gave quite a positive perspective on the situation in the country, thanks to the communist past, there are issues that might look a bit hidden, but for insiders, I think are quite perceptible. Women are in the lower end of the labor market in positions that are usually low paid. One need just to turn on the TV, look at the commercials in Bulgaria to see how women are portrayed by media and businesses advertising their products, to see that there is something going on and there is still great scope for improvement on gender matters. Another point that I would like to flag up, and it goes not just for in the area of gender, but in general, ensuring equality in practice, the notion of merit, and Dimitar, I'm sorry, but I'm going to talk about lessons, not about experiences. So I think we need to learn about the notion of merit, and merit is something which is constructed by the very same society. So I wouldn't say that women or minorities have less merit than others. Just we need to deconstruct our notion of merit and start valuing other people, different people's experiences and what they can bring into a certain profession. And this is not just about representation. It's also about legitimacy of decisions that these bodies are going to make, be they judges or policymakers. In a way, having a woman's perspective or a Roma perspective or any minority perspective in a decision makes it more effective, and let alone legitimate. It's no surprise that minorities do not trust the judiciary because they are not represented at all there. But obviously in Bulgaria, no one trusts the judiciary, so it's a broader issue. Should I go on talking about the role of courts, or we will open for questions? Okay, I'll be quite brief. I want to discuss very briefly, again to flag up the point about the role of courts in South Africa's transition. Courts have been quite an active, had a quite an active role. And it's a bit unusual role for judges to deal with social justice matters, to deal with social policies. And this is the point that I want to focus on. Judges in South Africa address redistribution and review redistribution policies, something which we're used to see in the hands of governments and agency and the executive. So it opens up a lot of questions that we haven't had, we haven't discussed here in this country, not just in Bulgaria, but in continental Europe. What does it mean for a judge to review an educational reform, or to assess how a health policy is addressed by the government, or how a housing plan lives up to the government commitment to the right to housing? And I think the key is, again, in the South African constitution, which I agree with Daniel is very similar to the Bulgarian constitution and any other constitution under the sun. But the South African constitution includes civil and political rights and socioeconomic rights, and it puts them on an equal par. Arguably, in the rights in human rights law, most people believe that civil and political rights are right to life, prohibition of torture, freedom of religion. So these are rights that require immediate implementation. They are cheap, they do not involve a lot of resources, and they are most importantly justiciable. You can go to court if any of them is threatened. Normally, I mean, arguably, civil and political rights involve duties on the part of the states to... civil and political rights. They involve duties to respect and to protect. You know, the state should not breach our right to life, and it should protect it. But arguably, the right to life doesn't involve a duty to promote and to fulfill. This is unlike socioeconomic rights. They're not that much about respecting them. Obviously, the state should respect the right to food, but actually what we expect from it is to provide and to fulfill it. And that's why it's very complex to deal with this kind of right at the constitutional level and at the judicial level. It has to be at the executive. It involves a lot of budgetary resources. It doesn't happen overnight. It involves a progressive duty to gradually build and develop certain policy and to deliver on it on a daily basis. And these rights are traditionally non-justiciable. You cannot go to a court and say, I need the government to reform the educational system because I'm not satisfied with the level of education that I'm provided with. How do you enforce this in a court? And that's why here we do not touch this issue. We don't give them to judges. In South Africa, I think what the lesson is that they faced up to the real problems that the society face and just abolish boundaries and thought outside the box and say that if you have these problems in society, we need to think outside the box and find other solutions to make the process fairer, equitable, transparent and participatory. And here is the role of the court. The South African Constitution in Section 7 says that all human rights across the board have involve duties to respect, protect, fulfill, and promote. And then the courts received a jurisdiction to overlook how governments and agencies live up to their commitments and duties. The courts in South Africa acknowledge that these are progressive, the right to education and the right to health and housing are progressive, involve progressive obligation, and therefore the obligation of the government is not to deliver immediately, but to take steps. In knowing our part of the world, when a government has an obligation to take step to achieve, we know that the government does whatever it wants to. Yes. Because also it also involves that the obligation is not only progressive, but it's also construed within the maximum available resources. So anytime you can say we don't have enough resources, then it looks like you're free not to deliver in it. And here comes the I think the very useful lessons that we can get from South African courts and especially the Constitutional Court of South Africa. It interpreted this provision in the light of three principles. I mean, we can extrapolate them, not written in the Constitution, but we can extrapolate them in the case law, the Grootboom case, the Port Elizabeth municipality case, and many others that we've seen courts doing unusual things. So the first principle of accountability. The courts would interpret this obligation to take measures, to take steps, in a way they would ask the government to step forward and to report on what they have done. What measures did you get? And these measures need to be progressive. So if you report the first year on a certain measure, you cannot report the same thing the following year. It needs to be progressive. And also you need to report on the resources you spent on those measures. So if it turns out that a certain government spent more money on a sports hall or a stadium instead of on children that are not well fed in institutions, that means that there is a problem in the priorities of this government. And this is not, it cannot sustain a socioeconomic rights test, because socioeconomic rights is about priorities, where we put our money in, and the courts have a role to monitor on the process, that whoever needs them gets the money. They also, the second principle that I can single out is the principle of equality. And I prepared a quote here from the Grootboom case, which says that basically, it says there is no progressive obligation when it comes to the most vulnerable people in society. It's immediate. You need to deliver immediately. I mean, you can stop building highways, but you can immediately fulfill the following. A program that excludes a significant segment of society cannot be said to be reasonable. Those whose needs are the most urgent and whose ability to enjoy all rights is most in peril must not be ignored by the measures aimed at achieving the realization of the right. The Constitution requires that everyone must be treated with care and concern. So we're not leaving anyone out of the development processes. And the third principle is the principle of participation, basically giving voice to the voiceless, because it was realized, it's again very context-oriented, that minorities and people that have been excluded and marginalized for centuries, they will be excluded if they are left simply on the political process. And this is the court that needs to stand up for their rights. And the court has been very vigilant in this participatory dimension. And when as lawyers, we just take our breath anytime we see a judge saying, okay, so this is the problem, go away for 4 weeks and come back to report to me in 4 weeks what you have agreed on. So it's a judicial, it's a case, basically, which for us is very surprising, but it again says how creative the judiciary could be and how judges can be used in order to basically foster social justice. I was hoping that I can somehow transpose these examples in the Bulgarian National Roma Strategy. And you know that for the last 20 years we've been writing strategy after strategy in order to overcome the marginalization of the Roma. And I think that some of these examples can be used by courts and asking governments to report why they have committed on public plans to integrate the Roma communities and do not spend enough resources, do not strike the right priorities. A South African judge would return immediately a Roma strategy that says that we are going to improve the literacy rate among girls, and the judge would ask, I want you to put how many girls, where, when, and how many. And also within the principle of accountability, all South African judges, when they look at these cases, they want to see who is in charge and which institution is supposed to deliver. On this note, I'll stop.
Thank you so much for connecting the South African experience and jurisprudence of the Constitutional Court to the real dilemmas we face today. Because obviously social justice, the rights of marginalized groups are topical in this country, as we see very much at the top of the policy agenda as we speak. But I should thank to the audience for being as patient, and I'll turn back to you to react, give us comments and pose questions to Ambassador Camara.
Can it serve as a source of inspiration for countries like Afghanistan or Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Libya, emerging from either conflict, strong domestic conflict, such as Afghanistan, or totalitarian rule like Libya and Egypt especially? Thanks.
Maybe some other comments, anybody else? With a burning question. So maybe, Sheila, I want to push you a bit more on the Roma issue, how you see that. Of course, there's a difference because in South Africa it was the majority, whereas here you have a minority. But still, I know you care about this issue, so if you share a few remarks about it as well.
Yes, well, the first thing that sprang to mind listening to Danny and Galina, that basically you're talking about marginalized minorities, whereas our majority was marginalized. So it's a different setup altogether. Although within the framework of the South African settlement, we do have minorities that need to be catered for. But as I said to you when we talked about the so-called culture commission that protects language, religious and cultural practices, there's no mention of minorities and there's no mention of race. I mean, it's cultural communities we're talking. I mean, we have to steer away from what was wrong with our past. Issue around the TRC, if I can. Look, there are quite a few things I wanted to say about both the other discussants. You've mentioned the TRC. I mean, South Africa is a little bit inclined to think that one size fits all. We our formula succeeded. And so we would like to see a political settlement in all these countries, in the Arab Spring countries, for instance. I mean, I can remember sitting embarrassingly in the Atlantic Club on a panel, and I'm talking about a political settlement, the way forward. Our president spoke to Gaddafi and they want an inclusive political settlement. Meanwhile, I'm saying this and the NATO is bombing the hell out of Libya as I spoke. So, I mean, people looked at me as if I was nuts. I mean, one size doesn't fit all. But, for instance, in Egypt, if I may say, the South Africans were quite shocked that Mubarak was brought to trial. I mean, the Nuremberg element came in. I mean, it didn't work. We tried to avoid that in order to have a peaceful settlement, inclusive, negotiated. Okay, I mean, you know, de Klerk was roundly condemned by Mandela during the 3 years of intensive negotiations from time to time. But it didn't stop the negotiation going forward and a settlement being reached in the end. So to us it was a pity that Mubarak, for all his sins, was put on trial. I mean, it just seemed not the way to go, to have a peaceful resolution inclusive of everybody. But one science doesn't fit all. Yes, I mean, if you can get it together, as I said, the TRC was a healing process for South Africans generally. Don't forget, I mean, we were talking about decades of really heavy discrimination and, you know, a security force that was at times out of control. I mean, they did awful things. And the victims came forward and told their stories. And everybody who came, who was certified as a victim in the end of the process, got a monetary amount as reparation, a symbolic more than anything else. But the TRC was also able to take into account where, for instance, children were left fatherless, or the parents had been mutilated or disabled through reasons of security force action. They would get special dispensation and their education would be paid for. So all that was going on as well as part of the TRC process. But the main point about it was truth-telling. As I said to you, the two main protagonists in the negotiation didn't obey the rules. The African National Congress didn't each one come forward. They produced a document signed by 37 top ANC leaders and said, that's it. We were all part of the struggle and we did awful things, but that's it. And de Klerk claimed on behalf of his outgoing government that people want to know what he was going to say, not the people who were part of his government, said that he never knew, he never committed any atrocities and so on, so he had nothing to confess, I mean, basically. But so from the people who'd negotiated the settlement in the first place, none of the political leaders actually came forward and admitted guilt, but the people lower down did. And there were very few people who actually went to jail. There was a proportionality test that if your deed was so grossly excessive in terms of your political motive, then you wouldn't get amnesty. And there were a handful of people had to go, you know, went to jail, actually, as a result of what they confessed to. But, I mean, it was a very small minority of those who confessed. So, yes, I mean, we think that truth commissions work, but I don't think you can apply the same rules all over the place. I mean, the Chileans did it in a completely different way. When we went to study their truth commission, we were shocked when we got to Chile to find that the former president, the outgoing one, was the head of the army, and the new liberal president was in office, and they were coexisting. I mean, this is something very peculiar as far as we were concerned. So
we can understand that.
Yes. So, I mean, everybody has their own formula. I would hate to prescribe to anyone, but I did think it was a pity, for instance, that Egypt went that route rather than conciliatory, and also rushed the constitutional. I mean, I don't think it was very well handled, frankly. I just want to make the one point about the, you were talking about the judges. In a sense, South Africa follows the English system, so we have a split profession. We have have the higher courts, and we did a top-down approach. I mean, it's actually easier that way, I think, to put the newly elected constitutional court to set the norm for the courts as a whole. We had the Judicial Service Commission to appoint the high court judges, and then the lower courts carried on regardless. I mean, we had everything sitting there as a magistrate, from the homelands, semi-educated guys. I mean, we established a magistrates commission to keep them all sort of going and to try and establish standards, uniform standards, but at a lower level. So you don't have that. Yours is kind of all mixed up. I'm not quite sure how it works. But so I think it was easier for us to introduce a sort of cleaning up from the top down and so on. Unlike Bulgaria, a lot of our women, prosecutors were women, including myself, I left law school.
Other questions from the audience? Yes, Mr. Pirinski.
Thank you very much, and it is a privilege to be participating in this discussion this evening. It seems that in a way there is another similarity because, as Ambassador Kammerer mentioned, it's 20 years since 93. There is a kind of reassessment or kind of stocktaking as to where has South Africa arrived at. There is the same kind of process as we are witnessing now in a rather drastic fashion in Bulgaria. 23 years are being mentioned as a period of mostly disappointment by many. And you mentioned in your initial remarks that there is this common point between the two constitutions being built on human dignity, on the individual as the bearer of rights under constitution, which should be basic to every human being. And you described the various intricacies in arriving at that state, having in mind tribal tradition, etc. And probably today it is worthwhile to reflect as to what is actually at the base of much of the frustration and disappointment manifested in both our society and, as you mentioned, came to the fore, I believe, last autumn with the disturbances at the mines and a general sense of actual disenfranchisement by a large part of the population that felt or feels left out. And you touched upon two criteria, which again we seem to be rather close on, the Gini coefficient and the corruption index. And I would be truly interested in your thoughts as to what is actually generating these disturbing actual facts of life that do not tend to correspond to the high constitutional norms, principles, and the expectations bred by them. And I would bring up the proposition that where we might be looking at reasons, basic reasons, is the way societies and economies and states have been developing over the past roughly three decades with the paradigm of markets and money as the center of societies and the notion and the actual process of a very far-going degree of marketization of the exercise of rights more and more, a kind of pervasive influence of money in the functioning of supposedly independent public institutions. And clearly, where is the answer? Because today we are witnessing a crisis of the parliamentary system, a growth of extreme supposedly solutions from what is happening in neighboring Greece to what we are observing perhaps in our countries as well, a kind of extremism on the left. It seems that there is a tendency in the African National Congress, particularly in its youth wing, to seek a different approach to the ills of society. We are witnessing at the moment a kind of process perhaps of the similar nature in some of the protests that we are witnessing here. And basically, what I think is worthwhile thinking about is the possibility or the chances of a kind of new deal, which in the original case came to overcome the failures of what was known as the Gilded Age at the time. I fear I have gone a bit too long, so I will stop here. Thank you.
But if I'm allowed to sharpen this question, yes. For us in the 90s, marketization and democratization was one and the same. They were mutually reinforcing projects. Do you think in South Africa, just going back to what Mr. Pirinski had to say, and maybe nowadays here as well, the market and the culture of human rights you were mentioning, are there some trade-offs or tensions?
I think there we kind of part company. I'm not sure that it's entirely the same, because South Africa has never been governed by communism. We strictly market from way, way back, you know. So, but it wasn't democratic. And the market system, the market economy was only a limited number of people benefited from it. And the challenge for South Africa has been to extend the benefits to the whole population. I mean, if I just take education, for example, no government in South Africa thought of educating the black people until 1954, when the church, actually, the Catholics, were the only people who were running schools for the black population. So, there's been a... And then apartheid came on top of that, and from 1948, we're now sitting where everybody has the right to education, and the progressive realization of the right is an obligation of the government, and the government has to respect the human rights of all its citizens. So you have, enormous burden on... In fact, it's by far and away the largest amount item of our expenditure is on education, with a very poor result, I must say, because we've got to remedy decades of neglect. Even today, we're seeing this situation. So, the fact is there was a market economy, but it didn't benefit all the citizens. And as I tried to show you with the GDP growth, it's greatly improved the situation. In his State of the Nation address, which was, I think, just the day after Barack Obama's, our President Zuma listed pages and pages of the achievements of the government and how, hundreds of thousands of households have now got running water, and which seems ridiculous coming from Europe, but it's a huge reality. Apparently only 10% of all our households now don't have running water in their houses, but it was a huge number in 94. So, we've got these enormous backlogs to make up. I think we approached the problem from different directions, really. You had to get over the what was the commonness, what the devastation of communism as far as the economy is concerned. And somehow it was badly managed at first, I gather. But we didn't have that problem. May I just briefly say something about Irene Krugman's case, which I put it in brackets in my notes, but all I right. didn't want to go into too much detail because, was worried about the time. But it's a very important case, I think, internationally. But Irene Grootboom was a leader of a group of squatters who squatted on land outside Cape Town, a bit of land called Marconi Beam. And anyway, she took her case eventually up to the Constitutional Court, and then the court got very proactive and got very cross with the... In fact, she got there twice. Because she, and that was a turning point for the Constitutional Court to get more proactive, because they gave a ruling and said, you know, her progressive rights must be, you know, somebody must do something about these squatters. And then a few years later, she showed up there again, and nothing had happened. So they really got very fierce with the Cape provincial government and said they absolutely have to get these houses built, because, I mean, we have a lot of squatters outside Cape Town. And well, in Cape Town, for that matter. And so the government was put under pressure, but sadly, she died before any houses were built. So that was 2 years ago. And I don't think they've been built to this day, but not for want of trying on the part of the Constitutional Court.
This note, maybe I should pass the floor again to the discussant, Daniel. One thing that Gala mentioned is this activist role of the judiciary filling in gaps in the government social policy. And she said that obviously there's some parallels to be drawn with Bulgaria and opportunities out there. So what do you think about that? Is it?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, actually, because... Well, the Bulgarian constitution has quite a lot of socio-economic rights. Well, partly this is the communist legacy, but partly this was part of the transition consensus at the time of the roundtable talks, that these things should be put into the constitution. So it's not fault of the constitution that these rights are not put into practice. Later on, the Constitutional Court actually has developed different doctrines according to which these are not really enforceable rights in the way they are in South Africa. But I remember there were many constitutional debates in the beginning. For instance, even very progressive American scholars like Cass Sunstein, they worried that... If these rights are made justiciable and enforceable, this would undermine the rule of law because then people will start politicizing the courts and so on. So this was the first worry that from a constitutional point of view that we had. Now there were some constitutional courts in the region, like the Hungarian Constitutional Court, for instance, which tried to apply in serious socioeconomic rights. And in the middle of the 1990s, the Hungarian Constitutional Court almost blocked certain austerity measures, which then Finance Minister Bokros was trying to introduce. And the court was successful, although again, as in the Grootboom case, not entirely successful, because the power of courts in these areas is not tremendous. So this is the Eastern European perspective, and sometimes actually, for instance, the Russian Constitutional Court at one point, it also tried to be more active in the socioeconomic area. But my guess in this case was that it was mostly because the court couldn't do much in the political rights area, so it focused in the socioeconomic. So this was another kind of policy decisions. Anyhow, so this is the Eastern European background. But what worries me in our case, it's not so much that probably the judges and the judiciary have not become activists in this area, but even political parties have withdrawn from this type of socioeconomic agenda, and we have had for quite some time, as actually Mr. Pirinsky said, almost across the board political consensus that the role of the state in general is different. So it's not so much to try to achieve some sort of social emancipation, but to provide, let's say, the ground for more competition, market economy, and so on, to have a more minimal type of state. And even actually socialist and social democratic parties in the region, they have not been activist promoters of a very socially oriented emancipatory agenda. And some of them have advocated, let's say, measures like flat income tax and others. Yes. So this is one of the characteristics of the political process, and probably now we see some sorts of adjustments in this. I'm not sure whether in Bulgaria these adjustments should start from the judiciary, because the judiciary, it lacks trust to engineer and to stand behind such a radical policy turn, but I think probably this should come from the political process in general, if such an adjustment is necessary.
So maybe Gala can come back to Daniel. Given that there is a generic problem with political culture and political consensus, can we expect the judiciary to pioneer such activist role, or is it up to the...
In general, I think that we lack a consensus on social justice, on the model and concept of social justice that we want to see in this country. So that's the main issue. Otherwise, we need to somehow to mainstream socioeconomic rights-based approach to social policies and give voice to the voiceless. Somehow, I think that I agree with all the points you made and the negative side on empowering judges to basically take executive decisions. But somehow, I think that judges are better placed are well placed to be involved in this process. This does not necessarily mean that it takes out policies from policymakers. It just they become the stakeholder that monitors that policies move within a human rights track.
Well, I think, Sheila, you suspected me of a conspiracy because I had it on this day. But I mean, I must confess, there was a conspiracy to use the South African example to start a Bulgarian discussion about many of those issues that Daniel and Gala were firing back and forth. So I'm very thankful to you, but maybe you could say a few words to close the discussion.
Well, just on this issue of you know, judges intervening in policy, of course the government absolutely hates it. And I mean, not a few months go by in South Africa without some government minister or other complaining bitterly about intervention in policy as sacrosanct. But they're unfortunately faced with the Constitution, which says something different. So the judges are truly empowered by our constitution to intervene, and they can hold, as you mentioned the word, the government to account in terms of what they're meant to do, and they have. And so I think that's a very positive thing. I hope that if the judges haven't done it here, possibly they should start.
I should thank you for that. Yeah.
Because I think that behind the issue of how powerful the judiciary and judges should or are is what I think Galia and Daniel mentioned, a more basic understanding as to what is just or unjust in a social sense, and what is actually the role of the state or government in providing those expectations, which you have been discussing mostly in legal judiciary terms. And this is actually what I was trying a bit to introduce with my previous remark, that the workings of the market as such breeds inequality, and it needs a regulator, a counterbalance to this natural force of markets to generate winners and losers. And what Mr. Smilov pointed out is to a large extent true. There has been this understanding in society in Bulgaria that the big government is bad, basing oneself on the experience from the previous period of rule. However, it is not totally true that all share this view or shared this view. It was introduced in the early 90s by the then young prime minister of the Union of Democratic Forces, who made the point that the government is a bad manager, period. Therefore, everything should be privatized and marketized. Now, the socialist left in Bulgaria never took that point as true. We always try to point out that there has to be a balance between the market and the public authority of the government. And actually, I don't want to enter into debate on local politics and experiences of different governments, but the previous government had a very strong socially oriented policy. It should not be limited to the introduction of the 10% flat tax as the legacy of the government. Over 40 social benefits and rights that were introduced from maternity, health, et cetera, were turned back by this government that is now going out. And if we talk about social justice, the rule of thumb, I guess, would be when you reach unsustainable levels of inequality, which is a fact of life, unfortunately, as we see it in the streets in Bulgaria today, and which is a fact of life in a globalized economy, which has been giving free rein to market forces that certainly generate levels of inequality which have reached unsustainable levels and which now require a very rigorous, a vigorous counter effort. So I don't think we should charge courts with overpowering expectations.
Can I just respond briefly? George, can I just respond briefly on that? I mean, we have a strictly market economy, but combined with a huge system of social grants. And it's been actually, we have a very high unemployment level, especially among the youth, as you may have come across this in the paper. But the social grants have vastly expanded over the last 10 years. And it's actually been very beneficial as far as uplifting the rural communities. And it actually gives people bus fare to get to the local town to try and get a job. The combination of a market economy and a very extensive system of social grants, which was introduced, has actually helped quite a lot in preventing a sort of move towards socialism, I think. Yes, exactly.
Just one short sentence on the judiciary and its role. And I think in Bulgaria there is a very strong case for judicial interference in minority-related cases when it comes to socioeconomic rights. Because generally, for the majority, I believe that political parties and the political process should be the main drivers. But when it comes to vulnerable minorities like the Roma, apparently, if they're left to the political process, the question might not be solved. So there, probably, the Bulgarian judiciary should be stimulated to take a much more activist role.
Institution, children's rights are not qualified by anything about progressive realization or depending on money being available, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's actually, they have absolute rights, all the children's rights listed. So they're, because they're a vulnerable group. I mean, one could define other minorities or minorities in a country as that.
Please join me in thanking the speakers for this really thought-provoking discussion. I must say that not only we had complied with the quota principle in the sense by being 2x2, but also merit-wise, I think we did remarkably well. So thank you, Sheila, being with us, and thanks for you.